solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Go deeper or do a jugalbandi. Go deeper or sing a movie song. Look more into Todi Ragam and Karahalapriya Ragam, because that one ragam will take a lifetime. Or say yes to Life of Pi. I don't believe I have attained any kind of a balance. All I can say is I have learnt wherever. And the learning here has helped the other side. The learning here has helped the other side. So, and I'm constantly having these multiple pathways in my life. And there was a point when I thought, no, I'll just do one. But before I know, the most tempting opportunities hitting my back and saying hello. So it never happened. And I see this as the way of my life.
Welcome to the 33rd conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. A series of reflective conversations across three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach and I help leaders and organizations play to their unique potential by engaging with them during periods of high-stakes transition. You could see transitioninsight.com for more details. This podcast is a passion project of mine, where I've been speaking with individuals from various fields to decode their responses to two questions from their journeys: where to go and how to grow. We discuss how these individuals have made crucial choices that has changed their trajectory and how they've evolved as leaders in their respective fields. Just to give you a sense, the list includes sportsmen like Vishy Anand, Vijay Amritraj, and Viren Raskina, CEOs such as Nanda Nilekani, Vinita Bali, Suresh Narayanan, and Meher Padamji, thought leaders and writers like Devdutt Patnaik, Rama Bijapurkar, and Amish Tripathi. I try and divide up each conversation into smaller nuggets and curate the content so that it's easier for you to access them in a targeted way. Please visit playtopotential.com for more details and sign up to be intimated when we upload new content. My guest this time is the accomplished Carnatic musician Jayashree Ramnath, also popularly known as Bombay Jayashree. She's performed across 20-odd countries and has collaborated with a range of artists in India and overseas. She was nominated for an Academy Award for her collaboration with Sir Ang Lee for the movie Life of Pi. She's also involved in discovering the healing power of music by working with autistic kids. In this conversation, we talk about how she practices for her concerts, what she learnt by observing her guru Sri Lalgudi Jayaraman in action, how she's made some crucial choices about going broad across genres versus going deeper into Carnatic music, and how she leverages music as a platform to make a difference. At the outset, I should mention that if you want to listen to the conversation offline, say during an airplane ride or during a gym session or another time, you could access the podcast at iTunes, Google's podcast player, Stitcher, Savan, or any of the other podcast apps out there. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Bombay Jayashree. Jayashree, thank you so much for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Pleasure.
And maybe just to kick things off, I'm curious about how you think about time today. How do you spend your time, and more importantly, give us a sense of also why you do what you do today.
Most of my time is spent around music, of course, planning for the concert, what to sing, how to sing, rehearsing for the upcoming concert, thinking about what mistakes I made in the earlier one. Once in a way, I do record, so that means going to the studio and understanding the song, etc., etc. So basically, everything is around trying to make my work better.
Excellent. So Jayashree, let's rewind the clock. I'm curious about the point in time where you probably made the commitment to take music as a full-time profession. Talk a little bit about that inflection point.
The pathways were were created, I think, very, very early in my life when I was a child. Both my parents taught Carnatic classical music in our home in Bombay. My father taught, my mother taught. So waking up to music in the morning and going to bed with music, listening to their classes is what I remember. So there was music always, but that it would become eventually my career came much later. So it always meant going for school, participating in school competitions, intercollegiate contests, and then starting to sing jingles in Bombay, singing for documentaries, lending my voice for multiple languages, and then small concerts, and then a trip or two to Chennai to be part of the December festival. These were all little paths that came along my way. They just happened to be there. Mm-hmm. When I moved to Chennai to be under the guidance of my guru, Sri Lal Gudi Jayaraman, at that point, I think a couple of months after moving to Chennai is when I realized that this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
And if I may ask the question, how did you think about learning under Sri Lal Gudi Jayaraman? Again, talk to us a little bit about the choice of the coach, if I may frame it that way.
I was training with my parents always and with Srimati T.R. Balamani, a very, very loved teacher and guru in Bombay for several years. There was something in Chennai. It was a competition again, and I happened to receive a prize given to be my Lal Gudi sir. And he heard me sing, and I had an opportunity for the first time to hear his concert in Bombay around that time. And when I heard that music, I remember I was sitting on the floor. It was Gandhi Maidan Chembur, and I was sitting on the floor with my friend, and almost I was able to touch the end of the stage where the artists were seated. There was something inside me that told me, if I can pack a small bag of what I need and just go away with this, where this music takes you. I didn't even know what it meant or how it could be possible. Fortunately for me, when he heard me sing, he told my mother, if you send her to Chennai, I will teach her. And my mother wasn't sure, because it was a very tall order. I mean, somebody as great as he is, somebody as accomplished as he, a busy person, why would he want to take a young student like me who was just about learning to sing better? But everything, like I told you, the pathways just formed in my life, and I just had to make a very deep wish and deep desire. And I came to Chennai and I started training from him in 1989.
Very interesting. And you're saying those two were independent things. You attending that concert in Chembur and you him hearing you sing and saying, telling your mother. So yeah, I guess in a way, it both happened in parallel at the same
Absolutely.
Time. Absolutely. Fascinating. And around the 2 month mark after which you said you committed, again, what shifted, if I may ask, for you to say this is life?
So I came with a lot of self-doubt about myself, my music, whether this is even a pathway for me. Though all I knew and all I had learned and was trained was music. So my guru created that urge within me to be committed, to be motivated to practice. And he told me that, I have faith that you will take this up full time. And I think he saw it in my eyes. Me, Nana Abdina. And he said, yeah, only you can do it. So every word of that I remember now, only you can do it is what. So coming from someone who was a disciplinarian, who was an achiever himself, and there was nothing he hadn't achieved, and he was the ultimate musician's musician. And for him to say that to me meant a lot. It was a huge responsibility. After that point, it was it was me, it was a hope that he placed in me, and it was also I had to do it for him.
Very interesting. And maybe a related question for people who are at that crossroads. You know, often in a lot of families, you know, music is treated as a hobby or as a vocation on the side. But what advice do you give to people who are at the crossroads of, you know, making it as a commitment or making it as a career? What are the mistakes you see people making when they take that plunge?
I think if the music bug bites you, then it bites you hard. And if there's any youngster who comes and tells me, I want to do music all the time, I would just tell them one thing, plunge into it. But understand that you have to work persistently, long hours for the rest of your life, and you have to keep your motivation and drive up, and you should have the good fortune of someone guiding you, otherwise you'll be lost in this deep ocean. So if someone wants to take music, they must take music, because it's a very beautiful world.
And actually, if I may persist with that, of the three or four things you said, three are within your control: discipline, long hours, and so on. Somebody taking you up sometimes is outside your control. So for somebody who's sort of that lone voice out there, who's still yet to find, let's say, a home in terms of a mentor, what's the advice in those situations?
Yeah, it's possible they don't find that person, but they can find the inspiration around them. In several of the musicians who have given us the wealth of this music before, by listening to them, by working. I've realized when I work consistently, some of the answers just dawn on me. My guru is not around now, and I still have several questions and queries about the music. But then you seem to hear them if you look deep within. It's possible.
I want to sort of move to this notion of learning from gurus that you mentioned, and Sri Lal Gudi Jayaraman. But again, coming from the world of, let's say, the corporate world or the business world, you know, and if I think about how we have the coaching process where we help another leader achieve his or her potential. Again, you've learned under a few gurus, and specifically under Sri Jayaraman. What are some of the things they do that make them great gurus? Just decode that for us.
First of all, what they do itself inspires. In terms of their self-discipline, the way they look at the subject, art in this case. I remember when I came to Chennai and I started learning from my guru, he was about 59 and touching 60. And sometimes late evening after class, the household would not let me go back to where I was staying because it was too late to commute by the bus. So I would stay back. And at 4 a.m., his sadhana would wake me up. At 4 a.m. in the morning, he would start practicing his violin. And until 7 a.m., he won't come out of the room. So that relentless addiction to be perfect and to learn more and more and more. These are the things that they show you through their music and their lifestyle, their conduct. The second thing is, he had several students, but he would go to each level at a pace that was required. He would come to that level and teach you at that level and make you believe that you can do it. So give you the hope, give you the fundamental material to be able to achieve it. And I do believe he had a different material for each student, a different set of tools which he would say, you know, this is what would work for you. This is how you have to do it, but you have to do it. He was a disciplinarian, but he was very, very, very affectionate. He was very strict, but his eyes would well up if you sing well. He was very forgiving, but he was quick to be angry if you failed in doing your duty, which was to practice. So day after day, when you see someone whose love for music, a contagious love for music, when you can see it, then you're bound to be like that.
And going back to one of the things you said, you know, practicing from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m., I'm curious about this notion of excellence, right? How do people who are already at the pinnacle of excellence keep pushing to higher and higher? So give us an insight into how they practice. You know, how does he spend the 3 hours, and how is that different from just sometimes, you know, there's people often use this term deliberate practice, where you're sort of mindful about what you're doing. So maybe give us an insight into the nature of practice that some of these people do, and you do.
So it could be 3 hours, it could be four, it could be two sometimes, but it is mindful. There is a schedule there of how you split your practice. You have warm-up exercises for your voice. There are small compositions that help you build up your stamina to be able to ultimately render a 3 or 4 hour concert. And there are compositions to help you set your mind to think faster. Because a concert, like the word, is a concerted effort with many musicians on the stage, 3, 4, sometimes 5. So it means that everyone should have one voice in the end. In my case, it could be a vocal with a violin, a mridangam, and a kanjira or a ghatam in that case. But we have to sound like one beautiful voice. So there's a lot going on there in terms of giving space to each other, letting your ideas pace forth, but allowing another person's idea to come in. So in the end, it sounds beautiful. It sounds spontaneous. Because it's about communication. Music is about how well you communicate to your audience. But it has a lot of emotion, a lot of feeling, because Carnatic music is like that. So it's a combination of the heart, the mind, the soul all coming together in a unified, beautiful way, in a language that can reach immediately.
And if I may come back to the 3 hour ritual, you spoke about, you know, warm up, having a set of things you do to prepare you for the concert. How do you, again, if I were to use the term syllabus, you know, early in journeys, people have syllabuses that's available. But at that rarefied level, you create your own syllabus. So how do you fill the time apart from the...
I could start with warming up with familiar compositions, familiar territory, and then move on to learning something new which I wish to sing, for which I believe I need about 3 or 4 months practice, because I don't want to learn something now and sing it tomorrow, because I haven't internalized it so much. I want it to be second nature, and it should just flow through me, and I just be a conduit at that point.
3 to 4 months.
Yeah, I would think ideally for something to soak in, and for me to be able to, for it to flow out of me, it would take that, ideally it should take that, it should be given that much time. So I would move on to practicing something new after that, and then maybe I try, go back to something old and look at how much I can better it. There are compositions I may have sung 200 times, but I remember feeling that, you know, I've still not got this part right. Or if I've heard a greater version of it from a legend, then I want to try to get there to that point. So there's always so much to do with what I have learned and rendered many times. And there's yet so much more to do with what I haven't learned at all. Sometimes 3 or 4 hours doesn't seem enough at all.
And how do you get feedback as a musician? And when I say feedback, when you're sitting in that room alone, 3 hours, let's say you're starting off with a new song that you want to master, or you want to sort of feel and sing at the end of 3-4 months. And I'm curious, music specifically, the way you hear it is actually quite different from the way others hear it, the way the sound gets transmitted. So how does the feedback process work for you to get better over time?
The passage of time and having given a lot of time to internalization. Concert singing is one thing, but internalization happens only when you're alone. Just me and my very beautifully tuned tambura. Sometimes I can get lost just enjoying the beauty of the music. At that point, I tend to forget that I'm a subject there. that has to improve. And then I have to tell myself, okay, stop enjoying and swimming in the music. Work at how that can be achieved in my voice, which is another segment or another world. So there's always this agony of that world and this world, which is being someone who loves it, a rasika, and someone who has to internalize it to bring it out of you. But it's a beautiful process, and I'm always jumping. It's like the court, this side and this side. But I have to be very aware and conscious that I want the music, that beauty and that epitome of perfection to flow through me. It's not easy, but it's not difficult either.
And is there a point in time where you, I mean, I know you said 3-4 months, but as you practice, do you, what's the point you hit when you say, you know, this is concert ready? Is there a certain click that goes on in your head that makes you say it's concert ready?
Not exactly concert ready. I feel, yeah, now I must try it. And then it further gets readied as I sing it in the concert, because that seems to be another version altogether. Because I'm singing at home, it's just me, my voice, my thoughts, my creativity. But in the concert, it also has others participating in embellishing the music. Others who possibly you may be distracted or attracted to in terms of their way of playing the music. So that's another process where the music undergoes a lot of tuning, reshaping, shaping.
And maybe picking up on this dynamic in the concert, I'm curious about teamwork, right, as a theme. Again, of the various concerts you've done and people you've performed with, what's been your insights around, you know, when it all comes together, what are some of the pieces, if you sort of decode that, what are some of the underlying things that need to go right for you to come across as one voice to the audience?
First and foremost is to have a very healthy attitude and a peaceful relationship with everybody on the stage, on and off stage. The second is to, at least in my case, what I try to do is I try to empty myself completely before I go on the stage, without a baggage or without a notion of how I want the music to sound. I try to just, okay, now I'm just going empty. And I've often found that when I do that, and if everybody else is able to do that at the same time, which happens sometimes with people you've worked for a long time, you tend to have a kind of a leveling attitude with each other. And then the music takes over. We don't have to do much. I don't know if I can explain this in words, but I have had experiences that enrich in my thought process to believe that empty yourself, and then years of training and practice just flows through.
And how do you, and when you say empty yourself, it's a simple statement, but I'm sure it's complex. And I'll tell you why I'm curious about this. In general, we live in a reasonably distracting world, if I may use the term. So emptying yourself is actually quite profound at multiple levels as we go through life to do whatever we're trying to do. So give us a sense of how you empty, how you empty yourself.
Maybe what I mean to say is, now if I take a melody, I could compare it to, say, a river that flows through hills and valleys and pebbles and corals, and at every turn there's a nuance. There's a melody, there's what we call a gamaka or a anuswara. There are these inflections in music. Now this, when we look at a river, we just look at the beauty and say, ah, we're not thinking of all these things. When I'm trying to perfect, when I'm trying to learn a raga or I'm trying to perfect, it's like a river. Every raga is a different river that flows through me, and the nuances come through my voices. But when I've worked and internalized these nuances, this vocabulary, the grammar, for many months. After that point, I'm not thinking of the vocabulary that created that raga. I know it, but I must allow it to flow freely from inside of me, right? So I try to create that space inside me, and that's what I mean by emptying myself, so that river can gush out.
The other piece I'm curious about, Jayashree, is how you've made choices along the way, right? You've been nominated for an Oscar for collaborating on Life of Pi. You've sung movie songs. You've done Jugalbandi with other genres. You've composed a few. You've authored books. You're exploring the healing power of music. So how have you thought about choices along the way? Give us a sense of just the underlying thinking behind some of the choices you've made.
I was blessed because I came into a family that loved music and different genres of music. And growing up in Bombay helped every bit, because I was hearing the movie song, I was admiring the movie song, I was witness to several great Jugalbandis, concerts that I attended. At home, there was Carnatic music. I went to a convent, so there was English music there. I learned to play the piano. My brothers, older to me, would bring ABBA and Michael Jackson music home. And every bit of it we loved. We listened to, we admired with equal reverence. So when the pathways opened for me to be a musician myself, I had to find ways of creating these opportunities for myself. And in doing that, I have worked with some of the most wonderful artists. Whether it was in dialogue or Jugalbanti, I've worked with Shubha Mudgal, Ronu Majumdar, Leela Samson, Alarmeel Valli, Chitra Vishweshwaran in dance, Eero Hämeniemi, who is a Finnish composer. And every time I have a little journey with them, creating the music or singing with them or performing with them, I'm able to closely watch another trained musician's life, of how he or she looks at music, of his perspectives, of his dreams. And that fascinates me, and I'm always starving more for that. Mm-hmm. More and more of that is what I would love.
Very interesting. And what have you, again, if I were to say, again, if I took music as a profession, I know it's probably not the right term, but to say, let's say music as a category, again, what does it, and if you look at people who achieved excellence in their respective domains, whether it's the Carnatic classical or Western classical and so on, what are some of the, is there a DNA of a musician that you find? Are there some common thread across these people that you can point
to? There is hard work, an addiction for perfection, sincerity, never to give up, because sometimes you just cannot get a ragam or the composition. It doesn't flow. But one doesn't give up. No giving up. No. There are moments of self-doubt, frustration. But when I think all the great people that I have met, they see the greatness of purpose so much that at the end of the day, what they go through becomes very small. And that's what I see.
And when you say sincerity, what do you have in mind out of curiosity? What's behind
sincerity
it?
Sincerity means to do nothing else but music. To want nothing else but music. So much in here. The quest for knowing more, to learn more, to listen to more music, to perform. I don't know if there's another way of performing other than being the best. That is sincerity.
And the other piece I was curious about, Jayashree, was the of the choices that one makes. There's often the go broad versus go deep kind of a choice, in a sense, you know, stay rooted and go deeper and deeper into one domain versus embrace. How have you thought about that choice?
So I have had this question with myself, and I have shared it with a few friends who I thought would help me, but at the end I had to find the answers within me. Go deeper or do a jugalbandi, go deeper or sing a movie song. Look more into Todi Ragam and Karhal Priya Ragam, because that one ragam will take a lifetime, or say yes to Life of Pi. I don't believe I have attained any kind of a balance. All I can say is I have learnt wherever, and the learning here has helped the other side. The learning here has helped the other side. So, and I'm constantly having these multiple pathways in my life. And there was a point when I thought, no, I'll just do one. But before I know, the most tempting opportunities hitting my back and saying hello. So it never happened. And I see this as the way of my life.
It's interesting. I think what I like is, what I find intriguing is, it's less about the choice, but also more about learning from the choice, learning from that sort of tributary, if you go down that path. And that sometimes benefits a river, to use your metaphor. Very interesting. And the other piece I'm curious about is how your, again, profession is a wrong term, but how music has changed with developments in technology. One of the pieces I explore in my conversations is how people have tried to stay relevant as sort of the space around them has changed or disrupted in some cases. So talk to us a little bit about what you've had to do to stay relevant in your space.
There was a time when there were no mics in concerts. I mean, I'm talking about 60, 70, 80 years ago. Now, as musicians, we carry our own mics. We don't even depend on the ones in the auditorium. I have my own mic, I would find myself telling the sound engineer. When my guru learned music, he told me he even did not make notes on paper. It was all internalized here, in the head. When I learned from him, sometimes he would allow me to make notes. But the rest, I had to sing from memory in the next class. My students walk into the class requesting me, meekly though, can I record today's class? Because I might not be able to remember it. So it has changed. Technology does aid learning. But when one puts off learning to technology, when one becomes dependent, then one loses it all. I could have a class recorded with me, but if I push it for tomorrow because I have the recording, then it's of no use. I have to learn it then and there. Because there are so many subtleties in music, like in any subject, in art mostly, that I know a little of, that you cannot remember even after 2 hours. You have to sit right there and work it out. Start working out. So with technology, often we push all the responsibility on technology. And that to me is very scary.
Interesting. I guess, so that is sort of a student guru dynamic perspective, but as a performer, has technology required you to change the way you do things significantly in terms of the way you practice or the way you perform?
Not so much, but it's singing jingles in Bombay and singing film songs in a studio helped a lot with my sense of the mic. The mic does help a lot, because nowadays you need that equipment to be able to reach the person, just not in terms of transmitting of sound. There's a lot that happens with the mic. When my music reaches you, it comes through this little instrument. So it has aided what I do, definitely. As long as I know that, I can do even without that.
Got it. And you know, you've worked with Ang Lee in the context of Life of Pi. And again, I'm curious about working with people from different cultures and backgrounds, as compared to maybe Carnatic music, where most of the others might have come from a similar, cultural or a musical upbringing. What's some of the shifts that you need to make when you work from somebody from a very different space?
One is to be open-minded and to want that opportunity. So when they called me up and they read out the list of names, I was jumping with joy that I'm blessed with this opportunity. With reference to Aang, he's zen-like. He's calm, he speaks very little, but he will affectionately prod you to deliver what he wants. While rendering this song, I remember we recorded this in Bombay, and the song is very small, it's about 4 or 6 lines. But it took over a week to record that, to get finally where Sir Aang wanted us to, in Michael Danner. At the end, I think what he told me is, I want the child not to sleep to your lullaby. I want the child to feel safe. And I want that in your voice. And if you look at the way they have the song plays through the film, of course it lulls the child to sleep. It also wakes Pai up. It gives him the courage. And more importantly, it's the song, the track is used as a connect between the audience and Pai throughout. Only when I thought deeply, I realized how the song plays through the movie. So to work with someone, Sir Aang is universal. He may be Taiwanese on paper, but it's fascinating to work with somebody like him who loves what he does and knows what to get from the artist that he's working with.
That's fascinating. 5 days for a 6-line song. So how do you break that up? I mean, what happens in those 5 days? In the sense, even that simple thing you said about, you know, understanding the emotion of the song and bringing it in your voice. How does that play out for an artist?
So I think it was very similar to how I practiced Carnatic music. Basically, over that 5 days, though it was 5 lines or 4 lines, I was internalizing the melody. And it was a simple melody. It was an intense but very simple melody. So I remember even in sleep, those 4 lines were going on in my head. And I think that process is what was beautiful, and that was what was required. And that was why I was given the time. So I could internalize, and not just, if you see a mother singing to a child, it's not something she's learned 5 minutes ago. It's something she may have heard her grandmother sing or mother sing, which is inside her. And I'm lucky I was given that time to internalize it at least for 5 days. And interestingly, neither of them knew Tamil. But they wanted words that sounded, that had that relationship. When you hear the work, they wanted that warmth, that affection, the motherly love. So I would pick words, and they say, no, not this. This is a little harsh.
So you wrote the song, didn't
you? Yeah, I did.
Wow, okay.
And they were constantly telling me, no, I want a word ending in ah, I want a word ending in o. I don't want too much of sounds like rrr,
right,
which is there in Tamil. But they wanted the whole thing to be soft, melting, butter-like. So even for it, because they knew the audience is, it's a universal audience, and they wanted the sounds emanating from the lullaby, just not the voice, but the sound had to be that of affection.
And back to the point about, it's like the question I asked you, when do you, for people striving for excellence, when do you hit a point where you know, okay, I think we're done. I think we have a version that sort of, which is as good as it can get.
I think it's just the clock. Given a choice, we'd go on and on and say, yet another chance, some more time. But no, if it's 5 days, then you have to say stop. And then you have to tell yourself, maybe I have given everything that's inside me. I have to wait for another song to give another version of the beauty.
Got it. Just moving topics, Jayashree, how have you thought about juggling your commitments towards work and home? That's again a piece I'm curious about when I talk to women in careers, I'm curious about how they've thought about those choices along the way. How have you made choices along the way?
That's a continuous exercise of trying to divide your focus, energy and time in both spaces. But honestly, I have given most of it to the music. I have a very supportive set of people around me. Where I grew up, the family that I married into, they just let me be and took care of so many things that had to be done for my life to function meticulously and normally. I have missed a lot of occasions. It could be family outings, my son's school day, anniversaries, birthdays, weddings. It was always like, let's not invite her, she must be busy. She may not have a concert, but you know, she needs the time to rejuvenate or be by herself. It's okay, let her not come. So I have had really fabulous support always. But yeah, there have been many agonizing moments. I'd be away, far away, 5,000 miles away, and my son has fever. Or there's someone at home who would need just maybe my touch or love, and I've not been around. It has been difficult, but once I go on the stage, I forget that there could have been a moment when I'd fly back. Once I'm singing, I don't know. I don't remember anything.
Just moving forward, Jayashree, you do work in the space of autism. I'm curious about the therapeutic role music can play in people's life, not just in the context of autism, but just a wider point. Again, I learn music as a hobby, but that's a space I'm curious about. How do you think about the role music can play in improving people's lives?
I don't think there's anything better than art in making one a better person, a happier person, a more sensitive person, a person with some amount of equilibrium. At every point in life, whether it's a young child, a student, someone who's getting married, music is always around like a dear friend, a friend that demands nothing of you except to give. With respect to autism, it was more than a decade ago that I met a child after a concert in Dubai who came straight up to me, looked into my eye and said, you sang it wrong. And I didn't want to believe it, and I believed nobody around me heard it, because we are so used to hearing only adulatory comments after the concert. And then I did find out that her child was right when I heard a record of my concert, that I had made mistakes. And I also remember another four-year-old in Bangalore who was singing a very difficult ragam with such ease, something which students who've learned music for 10 or 15 years find very hard to navigate. One thing led to the other, and I started sharing the music with children with autism in schools, in special schools, in Chennai, in Bangalore, wherever possible, wherever I could find the time when I was visiting. And this led finally to my forming a trust, Hitam Trust, a kind of an umbrella for me to carry on the activities with my students, where we share the music with children with autism. I do believe many children with autism have a special flair for music. The roles reverse sometimes. In a typical classroom, it's not that I sing or I teach and they repeat. Sometimes I'm singing several times and they will not repeat. But after about a few weeks, you'll find the child singing the whole song in a refreshingly different way. Sometimes adding nuances which I have not sung, which I have not heard before. So it's magical how this happens with children with autism. And I just feel a deep need to do it as much as I can. And I do it with the help of many of my students.
And I guess a broader question, Jayashree, is how have you thought about using your platform, music, reach to make a difference to the wider community? Apart from this initiative on autism, are you involved in other social causes where you try to make a difference?
I work closely with Spic McKay in reaching music to schools and colleges in remote areas in India and even outside. I remember a military school in a regiment in Himachal Pradesh when they hadn't even seen a mridangam or they hadn't even seen anything like this. So it's hugely satisfying to be part of Spic McKay or some such organizations. At my own small level, with the help of my students, I try to reach some homes where we have seniors staying to reach the music to them because they can't commute.
So you go and perform there, you and your students?
Regularly. So because they just sit back in their homes and enjoy the music. Some small things like that.
Very interesting. And just looking ahead, I'm curious about how people think about the journey ahead and how they think about terms like impact and success as they view life forward. How do you think about these terms as you sort of think about what next in your life?
I think there's something about music when you keep singing. And the more you sing and the more you get into the music, words like impact and success sometimes almost sound redundant. And I just have to hear a 5-minute track of a past master. That would make me feel further that these words have really no meaning. How much have I succeeded in singing a melody better is a question I'd ask. How much has that melody or raga impacted me to flow through me is what I'd love to ask.
Jayashree, this podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about people discovering what they have potential for, whatever the domain might be, and then doing the best they can. So I'd love to hear your perspectives in summary for people to play to their potential. What are the couple of insights you want to leave the listeners with as we wrap up this conversation?
When I was in my 20s, I wanted everything, or maybe earlier, I wanted everything really go fast. Now, in my early 50s, I want everything to be very slow. So there's always a state of confused or time warp around your head, but the best is to grab the moment and do your 300% best, whether it's art or whether it's any other field, because the time gone is not going to come back.
And just maybe, I know I'd mentioned the last question, but one last, the notion of staying present, I guess when I look at musicians, I guess in a lot of ways they embody the notion of staying present to a set of audience, to a set of accompanying artists. And that's becoming more and more challenging with the advent of technology. So how do you practice the art of being mindful and present?
There's no other choice. You have to be present, aware, and completely dedicated to that moment at that time. There could be a mistake in my concert, but if I'm going to think about the mistake, I'm going to spoil the rest of the concert. I have to just push that mistake behind. It could be even a big mistake, which I keep doing, keep making. But I can't think about that and bring down my morale and bring down the morale of the musicians around me. I have to surge ahead and do so much better that seems like a small mistake. So the concert challenges you, the concert prepares you to be in the moment. And everybody is there. I can't tell them, okay, I'll send you a better version of the song which I'll record. It's just there. They will remember it for the rest of their lives.
That's true, actually. As compared to a recording in a studio, I guess concert is all present.
You can make mistakes. You're allowed. Flaws can be there, but I should try to not. And that's important. And that happens only when I'm there, 100%.
I hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did.
there were three big takeaways for me in this conversation. First is the point Jayashree makes about practicing a song for 3 to 4 months before she can perform it on stage, where it literally flows out of her. I want to relate that back to the habits we build that lead to behaviors that flow out of us. While I see a lot of people placing emphasis on skills and tools when it comes to development, not many people give adequate mind space to baking in habits in a systematic way over 3 to 4 months or beyond, so that appropriate behaviors flow out of us as if it's second nature. I see leaders with a growth mindset often systematically work on accumulating a balance sheet of habits around health, productivity and discipline and positivity, which shows up over the long term. My second takeaway is a piece around solving for the ecosystem, especially for women who pursue an active career. This might seem like obvious stuff, but the key takeaway is that solving for the ecosystem is possibly as critical as solving for your career at your workplace. Third is the insight around how we make a difference to the world around us. Sometimes we have this plain vanilla notion of social work, where you're of service to a community by doing grassroots social work. But in various conversations at the podcast, it's fascinating to see how people have combined their passion and background with purpose. Vinita Bali of Britannia spoke about her efforts with GAIN, Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, to improve health among underprivileged. Vedika Bhandarkar spoke about how she leverages the power of markets and finance in solving the water problem. Nanda Nilakeni spoke about using tech to solve large intractable problems. Paralympian Deepa Malik spoke about Wheeling Happiness Foundation, where she's building awareness about physically handicapped. I guess we all have our respective strengths, resources and passion, and there's an opportunity for us to leverage that and be of value to the community, then look at community service as a different set of activities. The real question often is, how can we use our background, our networks, our relationships and capabilities, and put it to best use to be of service to the world around us? And what are the platforms that we could plug into for that purpose? Thank you for listening. If you find the content in the podcast purposeful, please rate and review on iTunes. This will help others discover it. Signing off, this is Deepak Jayaraman, your host. To know more about the advisory work I do, you could visit transitioninsight.com. And look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.